If you want to take part in the Christmas card stream, now is the last chance for your card to arrive in time. Don't delay.
To understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2025. This is now night six, I believe. Yes, it is. And in 2 hours from now, I'll have Jack Mananoff on, and then Shlomo, and then Mark Weber. But first, it is Wilfings Publishing. I have consumer and sensible esocentrist who together run Wilfings. And neither has appeared on Millennial before, so this is another debut. Consumer, I'll ask you first to introduce yourself to the audience, your background, how you got into all of this. Let's not talk about Wilfings just yet. Just introduce yourself.
Sure. Hi, everyone. Thanks for having us on. So I go by Consumer in these spaces, and I'm the CEO of Wilfings Publishing. I suppose you asked how I got into this. So I'm kind of young. I'm a Zoomer. Now, like, I guess 10 years ago, you would have probably put me in the populist camp. I was very much a Trump guy. Also watched Millennial for a long time, for what that's worth. And was very much kind of in these spaces, but was very much of a lurker. Now, when that changed was really in 2023 for me, when I actually went to a Shillings Events conference. And this is where I kind of finally was able to meet kind of other people like us in the space, and I was able to volunteer with the Beowulf Foundation, which we'll be talking about soon as well. And from there, I met kind of a lot of very good people in our space, and we were able to start quite a few initiatives, one of them being Wilfings Publishing. That's kind of me. I suppose I can also mention I'm Swedish, if that's of interest.
Okay, good. All right, and Iso?
Hi, Wiz. Thanks for having me on. So I'm a Canadian from Ontario. I run the Beowulf Foundation. Part of that is Wilfings, as Consumer has mentioned. This was developed by us. But I got into this roughly 4.5, maybe 5 years ago. You know, I had been one of those guys who was drifting rightwards for a little while. And during COVID, especially in Canada here, with the way things got, I realized that I needed to not just be somebody who was, you know, sitting at home watching streams. I wanted to actually do something about it, because it had just gotten the degradation of this country has just been horrendous over the years, and the acute terror of the government at that time was quite severe. So when I found my way into some chat rooms with the guys who were forming the Beowulf Foundation before it had been officially announced, and I got brought in by our founder, Jay Greenriver, and over the years working as a volunteer in there, he trained me up so that I became he started getting me to run projects. And now that he has gone off to start some more secret projects, which we're not ready to announce, I've become the CEO of Beowulf while he's pursuing the other entrepreneurial means to develop this sphere. And that would have been at the beginning of September. So that's a little bit about me and how I came into this.
Excellent. Well, we can talk more about Beowulf in a while, but first let's outline Wilfings Publishing, because that is what people want to hear about. So, Consumer, what is it, and how did it come about?
Well, in a basic sense, the name is a bit self-explanatory. We're a publishing house, and we publish a few different types of books relevant to the space. Some of them are sort of bringing back old books into print that really kind of deserve to stay in print. They might have fallen out of print because they were canceled in their day, so to speak, or for some other reason. But we also try to engage in community activity, which is essentially working with influencers or smaller creators as well in the space to publish works, and essentially also to interact with people in the space. And we'll be able to talk about, I guess, volunteering in a little bit. Now, the way it came about, we do mention the Beowulf Foundation for a reason, not just because it kind of started from there, in that the people are from the Beowulf Foundation, but also in the Shieldings Events Conferences, which is another arm of Beowulf. We essentially were able to build kind of a canon of lectures that we had been producing into books. And we needed to find a way to, firstly, to sell these books and make sure that they're available to the people who want them. But then also we figured, okay, we have this capacity to make books. Why don't we do some more with it? And so we started with that. We've been making books for Shieldings Events on and off for the past couple of years, but we really started Wolfix Publishing this year in May.
Right, okay. Issa, would you like to give your perspective on this? So what Wolfix is, what you hope for it, and how you got involved?
Yeah, so for us, Wolfix is one of our... It's one of our main brands, so to speak. So the name comes from one of the tribes in the Beowulf poem. The other ones being Shieldings, which is our events company, and Brondings, which is a fintech platform that's currently in development. But it is actually in use somewhat, but it doesn't have the feature set for a regular user base yet. But beyond that, I think most people would know us for Basket Weaving, which is our meetup organization that we started during COVID in order to, you know, facilitate people from this sphere actually being able to get out and meet other people of like minds. And so within this, Wolfix is our exploration into the more of the intellectual side of things in the same way that Shieldings is, but with a focus, as Consumer said, on, you know, preserving knowledge and bringing back these things which are essentially lost to us or rendered unavailable would be a better term. And as well, of course, Jack Maninov will be coming on after this for Hialur, and that is another one of our main organizations that we've created.
Yeah. I think it's worth talking about the importance of publishing and paper, like book production, book making. That's not quite the right term, but you know what I mean. Obviously there's Substack, and I work on that. Lots of people work on that platform. Before that there was Medium. Before that there was Blogger. I can't remember all the others. But there is something unique and important about, well, first, the act of publishing itself, and second, the importance of actual books. I think both of you will probably have something to say about this, but I'll just say, first of all, I think there is a certain prestige or, what would be the word, legitimacy granted to something, bestowed upon something, when it is published in print, when it is made into a book, that doesn't, at least yet, exist in the digital realm. I mean, I'm not saying that Substack or the like are illegitimate. I'm just saying there is something that I think human beings perceive as special about a paper book, an actual physical object. Consumer, would you like to take that?
Well, I couldn't really agree more. There are quite a few ways you can kind of look at this from. Now, obviously, like, one important aspect of having a physical book is not just that it's physical and it's there, but you spent money and you own it now. It's yours, right? Now, if it's on Substack, in theory, the servers might go down. Even if you put it on Amazon, right, as a Kindle book, for example, a Kindle can be remotely accessed. But a physical book, you own it, it's yours. You can pass it on to your children if you want. And it's kind of a lasting testament, right? And you can put it in a library as well. That's a kind of an interesting, almost tangent on books, but like there's a legal requirement in most Western countries where literally all the books have to go into a library. And the point is of that is that even though, sure, you could save it digitally, having the physical somewhere is basically as good a way as possible to ensure that it's saved in some form. And obviously spreading it as much as possible in physical form means that, you know, it's not going to get lost on a hard drive, on a computer, or, you know, a Kindle that you have, but you throw away. You know, it's physical books have a certain permanence that that digital stuff doesn't necessarily have. So I definitely couldn't agree more.
ESO?
Yeah, there's a very interesting aspect to this because you mentioned Substack in there as a counterpoint. I mean, one of the books that has been published, Anti-Politics, is a collection of essays. I believe they've been edited or maybe expanded upon. I think Consumer knows more of the details there of exactly what's changed, but it went from being a collection of Substack essays to being a real book, and there's a sort of transformation in there from the hyper real to the real, right? Where it's no longer just, you know, voices in your head that you hear on the computer. It's something that you can hold and keep, and is no longer subject to this sort of ephemerality of the internet, where things are constantly changing and in flux, even when they sort of shouldn't be with something like Substack, which could just disappear one day.
Yeah. They're also a way to save speeches in that. So Anti-Politics also contains speeches. And for example, someone like Bowden basically only gave a speech in oration form, but like there are even lost speeches of Bowden because a lot of these stuff wasn't written in a book essentially. Yeah. Definitely, it's a matter of sort of preserving knowledge and kind of taking stuff out of the ephemeral sort of environment of the internet, making it real, which is a large part of what we do.
Yeah, I think also there's a sense of, as I say, legitimacy, and it's like something is almost made official when it's made into print. This is why. We used to use the verb publish. That now refers also to online digital stuff. But I think that word used to really mean, well, in the physical realm, it was something is granted a status, not necessarily that it's the best thing ever or that it's the unalloyed truth, but that it is seen as, to some extent, important. It joins the canon of that culture when it's published, and this is why I think that still now, even in this age where the internet is, you two have grown up with it. I was 12 when it became a thing, but still, it dominates our lives, and yet still there is a sense that to be published is something special. So this is why I want to have publishers on Millennial, because I think that this aspect of the movement is very important. It means that we are competing at a level that our rivals, those who disagree with us, our enemies, our opposition, have dominated for decades. So I think that it's very important that we do this kind of thing.
Yeah, and just your point, I mean, if you went up to somebody you didn't know and tried to tell them that you wrote Substack essays versus, oh yeah, I've published a book, it's a very different impression that you give whoever you're talking to.
Yeah, exactly. And it used to be the thing that a writer would be asked, are you published? And that what that meant was, are you basically, are you a real writer or are you just a hobbyist? Now, in the digital realm, that gets muddied because of what I've said, things like Substack. And as I say, I think this is why it's so important to have actual books in this digital age. Is there anything else that either of you would like to say about this aspect of it before we move on?
Yeah, I just think on the subject of being published, right? I mean, what it is it tells people that somebody else has looked at what you said and thinks that it's worth preserving, right? Which is it's not just a made up status symbol. That is something that's of genuine value.
Exactly. All right, so we'll move on and talk about what Wilfings has published so far. Now, obviously, it's a young, very young company, but you have published some books already. So we'll first talk about the Richard Hilton books, because that leads us on to several other topics in itself. So which of you would like to introduce this topic, Richard Hilton?
Well, that would probably best be me. So okay. I guess I'll just explain who Richard Hilton was. So Richard Hilton was a Major General Richard Hilton was a soldier in the British Army who served essentially from World War I all the way until the end of World War II and a short while after. He served in both the World Wars and also as a colonial officer in British India, in the British Raj. So he basically kind of saw the first half of the 20th century from a kind of British perspective on many different fronts, kind of politically and militarily speaking. Now, he, after his service, essentially, when he went into retirement, he wrote a series of books, 6 books in total, and we've brought back 4 of them so far. And these were books about British history, but also about contemporary politics, some books that essentially kind of got him canceled, so to speak. And that was, and this is obviously one of the main series that we've started to publish. And the first book we published was one called Imperial Obituary, with a foreword by Academic Agents. Might've heard of him, but essentially he, a year back or 2 years back, he essentially did a video where he read this book on his channel. But he was also pointing out that this book is very difficult to get a hold of, right? But at the same time, it contains a lot of very
I remember knowledge. That.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah, so essentially that book was very difficult to get a hold of in a paper format at all. So that was considered one of the kind of a prime candidate for us to try to bring back.
So I continue? Yeah. This is all interesting and valuable, so please just go on. It's good.
Yeah, I guess we can go into the book specifically in a bit, but I guess the process as well is that we kind of realized, okay, this is actually a book we would really like to bring back. And it worked as a very good kind of second major series for Wilfings since we did anti-politics first. So then we had to do essentially a lot of research to locate the Richard Hilton's descendants and essentially secure the rights. Which was also a pretty interesting process, but
I bet I'm very interested in that kind of thing because it's a part of excavating the past is finding out well how does it link with the present and do they even know about that they have this ancestor who wrote these books? Obviously you can't go into too much detail because it's real people, but please say as much as you can about that process.
Well, fortunately, we did have to do a lot of research, but fortunately, Richard Hilton was pretty well known due to his authorship, but he also had a son who was Sir Peter Hilton, right? So pretty well known on his own. We essentially had to look through obituaries, we had to look through newspaper articles to essentially locate the descendants, and we eventually got in contact with them, and they were actually well aware of the writings, and they were just, you wouldn't really describe them as into this space. But they were very happy to find that kind of someone actually cared, right? Someone actually cared about this knowledge and these books. And this is maybe something we'll go into later, but Richard Hilton in particular is kind of a kind of quintessentially British or like Victorian British or early 20th century British character. who kind of embodies kind of in his words, an England, like this is Hilton's kind of quotes in his own words that he writes in his book, an England that has since faded into history, right? Kind of like
really, and he was really writing like, that in the 1950s.
Pretty much, yeah. So if you can tell, like in England faded into history in the 50s, what does it mean now? Essentially, going back to the point of connecting to the family were just thrilled that someone kind of took an interest and was willing to give this, well, firstly, give it the time of day, but then also to, you know, bring it back in such a major fashion.
And not just one book as well. This is something I wanted to say, that I'm really glad that you're publishing all of his books. I think it would be a real shame if one of them got the attention that it no doubt deserves, but that the others were neglected and like one of them was just forgotten about entirely, or two of them just weren't published or something. I'm really glad that it's everything. I think that's important here. Could you talk a bit more about Richard Hilton as a man and why he, quote unquote, got cancelled?
Right. So, so Richard Hilton as a man, one very good way to describe it, if you've ever heard of like the, you could use the word caste or you could use the word archetype, but he's very much the warrior archetype, right? He is the type of person who is very brave in combat, always wanted to be in the army, even in World War II. So like in World War II, he's pushing 50, but he's still like essentially begging the staff, the general staff of the army to give him a combat position, right? Like in physical combat, right? Yeah. This is a real kind of warrior type guy. So after World War II, when he sees the British Empire kind of, in his terms, essentially just be given up, that really bothers him, right? Because he's thinking like, well, we could just go to war and like, you know, fix this, or you know, we can just use military force. Now, he wasn't immediately canceled as an author or anything. His first books were more just recounting his life. So he wrote, the first book that kind of made him famous as an author was a book called Military Attaché in Moscow. This was a book about his time in the Soviet Union. He served as the military attaché of Great Britain to the Soviet Union for 2 years. Quite a lot of adventures and anecdotes in that book. Unlike your standard ambassador, a military attaché is essentially an ambassador type position. You get diplomatic immunity, but kind of unlike most ambassadors, he would actually like try to go out as much as possible in the Russian, in Moscow and in the Russian countryside, and try to meet people and interact with them, which kind of tells you like he very much is the adventurous type. So that was the book that kind of first got him kind of famous. And during the Cold War, obviously, that's not necessarily going to get you canceled if you publish a critical thing about the Soviet Union. But then he published a book about his own life a few years later called Nine Lives. This is where you can find out all about his deeds in the First and Second World War and about his time as a colonial soldier. It's a funny thing also you mentioned like bringing back everything, because Richard Hilton also wrote a bunch of short stories essentially about inspired by some of his experiences. And we also included that in the new edition of his autobiography.
All right. Good.
Yeah. So you can get quite a few adventures from there. But there he starts to get a little more into like what he believes is starting to go wrong in England. This is where he brings the quote that England is fading into history. In particular, he kind of emphasizes that the character of the British people is, in his opinion, starting to become degraded, or at least that people like colonial administrators are not the same caliber of people that were involved 100 years ago, right? Meanwhile, essentially your politicians or your administrators are just people who kind of went to university but don't have a lot of real experience, whereas he compares this to kind of his own childhood, where you essentially have a boarding school. You know, it's a bit of a strict upbringing, but it also comes with a lot of adventure, which builds character. And this is a word he kind of comes back to, character. But after that,
that's a fascinating transition, because it seems that I can easily imagine that in the 1900s, in the early, like the first decade of the 20th century, there would still be the British public school, the boarding school,
yes.
And it would still be there'd be a sort of system in place for identifying promising people there, funneling them into the right training or the right university, and then funneling them into the industry or the military, whatever it was, politics. And they would be serving something. There'd be an overarching thing, the empire, God, king, country, and empire. And so everyone would be, there's a machine, a national machine there that works and works towards a particular goal, which is the preservation of the nation and the monarchy and, of course, the empire. But 50 years later, like after the Second World War, all of that seems to have just changed. Almost overnight, in 1945, and thereafter, you have this. It's a globalist machine. So there's the UN, UNESCO, NATO, and the beginnings of the EU. And so the same people, like the same boarding schools, the same public schools, would then be working towards that goal instead of the old goal, which very quickly seemed completely obsolete and out of the question. Just the imperialism itself seems to have been completely demonized after World War II. And it moved on to the American style, Pax Americana, where it's still imperialism, but it's much less overt. And it's much more sneaky, I would say, actually. But that's the whole thing about America. But just the globalistic paradigm, I think, is what took over. Obviously, we don't need to go into this in huge detail, but it seems to me that that is what he was witnessing and probably trying to make sense of at that time.
Yeah, and imagine how much worse it must have been for a guy like him who actually could have done something about it, right? I mean, it's not like us today where, you know, we see it on the news and there's a certain effect that that has on us. He's sitting there saying, you know, give me the men and I'll go take it back. And he could have, right? He had that capability, but was denied this.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Why can't we just do that? And the answer is that the whole apparatus above him was now captured and was now working towards a completely different goal. That must have been so strange for him because, as you say, he had the physical means, he had the expertise. It's like, why don't we just press the button and do this thing? But the signal just didn't come from above to do the thing. So and instead it was the signal to surrender and give everything up. I mean, it must have been, as you say, humiliating, baffling, and gutting, draining at the time. Either of you would like to take that.
Yeah, it definitely is. Like in his later books, he sort of accounts like colonial uprising, colonial upheaval, like massacred, like terrible things that happened in the colonial territories of Great Britain. And it's just like, hey, you know, we could have actually just like restored peace or restored order with, you know, a few hundred men, right? Right. But the government just kind of refuses to do this because it's essentially already given up the cause of empire. And he frequently compares, in particular, the books called The 13th Power and Imperial Obituary. We might go into those a bit later. In particular, he often compares, you know, like, okay, literally like 50 years or 60 years before he wrote that book, you would have had super jingoistic songs about how, you know, Britain would dominate the world, you know, the Russians will never take Constantinople. That was a common theme in British foreign policy, right? That you didn't want the Russians to go to India because that was the crown of the British Empire. And then you just transition to 50 years later and no one seems to care about that at all. And he even will go so far as to say, okay, would you rather have nuclear war or would you rather have a country? Would you rather lose your country in a way? Like he kind of views, and this is very much how you can see the warrior archetype in him, is that he just wants to ensure that there's something to be proud of and that the empire to him is very much something like that.
Iso, would you like to chime in on that?
I think Consumer covered covered that pretty well. Just the thing is, as well, though, is, I mean, you said that it was sort of would have been baffling to him. I think he actually understood quite well exactly what was going on. So it wasn't, you know, there was no bafflement. He was very, very biting about this, right? He was not right. Very, very unhappy with certain people who were pushing this.
See, it reminds me of this famous quote from Winston Churchill. I think in 1953, around about then, where he said, and again, I can't remember who it was that he said this to, but it doesn't matter. He said that immigration is the most important issue facing our country, but I can't get any of my ministers and he was the prime minister at the time, but I can't get any of my ministers to take notice of it, to take any interest in it. And of course, the numbers then were tiny of immigrants coming in. But the point is, compare that with the situation 4 or 5 years earlier with the Empire Windrush, where the British politicians were all against that ship landing. But 5 years later, there had obviously been some kind of complete change, which even Winston Churchill didn't really know about or didn't understand. But for some reason, his ministers were just not, they knew there's now a new paradigm and we don't object to mass immigration. And so it continued. And it seems to me that Richard Hilton was in a similar position and perhaps less baffled than Churchill was. But he was noting this complete radical switchover from national pride and empire to, well, globalism and the nation being subsumed, including Britain, the nation that at the seat of the British Empire, being subsumed into the system that we have now, which is that our country is just an economic zone. It's not something to be proud of. So it seems that something happened around that time, and I would really be very curious to find out what was the mechanism? What was the story there? Something happened in between the Empire Windrush and about 1953, and it seems to have been at a very high level. So anyway, just to get back to Richard Hilton, let's talk about each of the books in turn briefly so that people have a notion of what each of his six books contains, what it's about. Which of you would like to start us off there?
I can take that, and I'll go in kind of in chronological order of when they were published. So
yeah, let's do that.
I mentioned the first two, but I'll kind of do that again. So the first one was written in 1949, or published in 1949 rather, called Military Attaché in Moscow. This was Richard Hilton's kind of account of his time in the Soviet Union. Now, the reason this book kind of made him popular was that very few British people at the time were really able to get kind of a peek behind the Iron Curtain. You would have some people who would be taken on, for lack of a better word, guided tours by the Soviets. But basically, because Hilton, partly he spoke many languages, he spoke like 10 languages, so he was able to learn Russian pretty quickly to actually be able to get around there. But also he had diplomatic immunity in a way that kind of allowed him to travel around Moscow and its outskirts. So he was able to actually kind of describe the situation in the Soviet Union at the end of the 40s. And obviously it's just after World War II, so it's pretty grim. Some interesting things you might read about is essentially the type of hyperinflation that was taking place in the Soviet Union at the time, which maybe isn't too surprising when you think about it for a few seconds, but obviously you don't necessarily put the two together very often. But you also have lots more fun personal anecdotes about him avoiding spies or accidentally running into a concentration camp, as you might do in the Soviet Union. Essentially just a lot of personal adventures, which are kind of very entertaining to read.
Could you relate the anecdote of where the cover comes from? Because that's one of the best ones.
Yes. In one incident, Hilton is kind of walking around the streets of Moscow, and he walks by a factory, and he essentially gets stopped by quote-unquote factory workers. Now, in reality, these are Soviet government agents. But they essentially accuse him of being a spy. Obviously, the point is essentially to just slow him down and kind of discredit him in the media. Because what the Soviets end up doing is that, okay, in their own Pravda newspaper, they publish an article called A Letter by Four Factory Workers, right? Now, are they factory workers? No, they're just Soviet propaganda agents, right? But they essentially describe a kind of a distortion of reality where, like, oh, a British man in a sheepskin coat, the sheepskin coat is important to this anecdote, in a ragged sheepskin coat was like taking a pair of binoculars and had a camera and was taking pictures of our factory for espionage. But a funny thing the Soviets kind of do with it, I suppose 70 years later, or 80 years later after the Cold War, it's pretty funny. But they essentially make a giant propaganda poster, which is a caricature of Richard Hilton. And you can see the cover on the screen here, which is a lion in a sheepskin coat with like a pair of binoculars. And during this, this was essentially during a parade in Red Square. So they basically caricatured him personally in Red Square, sort of in the manner shown on the cover. Now, of course, they accuse him of being a spy, but then what you do to diplomats normally is that you attempt to expel them, but they didn't even bother trying to expel him. So you can kind of tell that these accusations weren't really with any merit. But and that is one of sort of many anecdotes that you can see in this book.
Okay, I was just getting the covers ready for the other books. I should have done that before. My apologies. So, okay, that's an account of his time in Russia. So what's the next book?
The next book is Nine Lives.
Nine Lives.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll get that one.
The Autobiography of an Old Soldier is the full title. Nine Lives, the Autobiography of an Old Soldier. And this is, as the title implies, it's basically his autobiography. I kind of recounted quite a few of the high-level details of this. Right, so he fought in the World Wars, was also a soldier in India. And this kind of goes through his life story up until basically the Moscow book that I just mentioned. So you have, he takes two chapters to talk about his childhood and upbringing. And this is where you get a lot of the stuff about the British kind of public school system and character, the type of character that would be built up, which he believes is kind of lost. Then you have chapters on the World Wars. So he was an artillery officer. Now, essentially, he went from trench warfare and kind of being an artillery observer to becoming a pilot. Because back in World War One, artillery observers were also pilots or put in planes because, you know, you can obviously observe better from the sky. So he became a pilot. But eventually he went back to the army and wanted to serve on the Northwest frontier of India. Now, the Northwest frontier is essentially the modern day border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And this is where he spent most of his military career. So you get quite a lot of information about what he did up there and also lots of adventures that he gets into. So he tries to sneak into Tibet, for example. Tibet is, at this time, Tibet kind of had a no foreigners in policy at all. So he had to sneak into Tibet. You also get essentially a feeling for what India, colonial India, was actually kind of like in the 20s and 30s. You also get a pretty good understanding of the Pashtus, because essentially in that region where Hilton was stationed, his main responsibility was dealing with Pashto tribes. Now, the Pashtos, these are the same, I guess you could call them the same ethnic group that are in the Taliban today. Now, it's kind of funny if you have that in mind and you kind of compare these to the people that Hilton is describing, because these are the same ethnic group, essentially. But Hilton kind of describes them as largely like almost like pirates, pirates and kind of bandit-like people. Whereas today they're kind of Islamist, but there is kind of a same cultural history there. But anyway, you get a description of essentially colonial India, and then he moves on to World War II. Now, World War II, Hilton got promoted pretty quickly. He eventually became a major general. So he ended up serving in Dunkirk. So he was part of the Dunkirk evacuation. And then he was also in D-Day. He did get injured in D-Day, which got him out of the fighting. But even though he was insisting to kind of get back on the front, like, oh, I've been shot in the leg, I'm 50, but I still want to fight, guys, please let me fight. literally. But what he ended up getting instead was a lot more interesting, and I guess you could say historically relevant. As a soldier, this is his most important or most famous contribution, is that he was actually head of the British delegation, so to speak, which accepted the surrender of Norway from the Germans. So for essentially a few days, while the surrender was taking place, Hilton was kind of dictator of Norway. So his responsibility was to disarm the Germans, make sure the Germans are following their surrender orders, inspect prison camps in Norway, essentially manage Norway on behalf of Britain, because it was a front in the war.
I just want to come back quickly as well on this point and say how it's so unfortunate, or maybe unfortunate is not the right word. It's very sad how a man who is this distinguished was left unpublished for so long, deliberately. It's hard to even think about it. There's no good reason why any man who had done all of this, should have had his books essentially shut out of the public eye for so long.
Yeah, and he won like several medals for his bravery in the First World War, in particular. He had the Distinguished Flying Cross. He had the I'm getting it up here, Distinguished Service Order, Military Cross. Like he was kind of a well awarded soldier. And you can read about a lot of those anecdotes as well in this book, right?
Right, and was this the point when he started to become controversial?
Not entirely. Well, he never became controversial at this point, but you can definitely see that this is a kind of a reactionary, or someone in the making who doesn't like this. He specifically goes into, even in the 50s, because this book was published in 1955. He's kind of recalling, because India had just been decolonized at the time, and he's recalling, like, well, they talk about this exploitation, but I don't know what they're talking about. Like, what do they mean? So he's already going after kind of the anti-colonialist narrative. Now, you can claim, okay, he is a colonialist in that respect, or obviously because he's directly involved in it. But so he's already sparring, so to speak.
Right,
but this is not where it happens. We don't have the covers for the next two books yet, but we're going to produce them and release them in January and February next year. The next two books that Hilton would produce are called The Northwest Frontier, A True Story for Boys. That's the first one. And the second one is The Indian Mutiny, A Centenary of History. So
basically, so do you want to talk about each of those in turn?
Yeah, sure. I'd love to give a preview of them. So I'll start with The Northwest Frontier. So Hilton was obviously served on this Northwest Frontier, which I kind of explained before. And he wanted to recount this history of this region and of British colonialism, in particular to a British audience. So The Northwest Frontier is the first book he wrote there. And it's specifically, the target group is specifically children. It's actually written in a simpler language, and it's designed for a reader who's around age 8 to age 12 to read. And it contains illustrations, which we're going to be bringing back in the book. And it essentially accounts the history of this is what the old version looks like. And we're going to be we're going to have to rework the cover, obviously, but this is what the old version looks like.
Yeah, I've got it up as a visual reference.
Yeah. And essentially, he is recounting the history of this region to British children, and he's kind of trying to answer the question, which obviously, if you think you're a British child in the 1960s, you're probably, even at this point, you're starting to get a lot of decolonial or anti-imperial narrative given to you. And he's trying to answer the question, well, why, what good did we do here? Why were we here? What kind of caliber of people, what were able to bring this place into the British Raj? And he is essentially, in a very entertaining way, telling a history story of the British Empire in a way that, like, kind of to use this type of language is not, quote unquote, woke or, anti-colonialist or essentially self-hating, right?
He was very forward thinking about this as well, just in the fact that he did produce this for children. He understood the necessity of producing something that would affect the generations to come. And it's a shame that this didn't spread further, because it's really really a wonderful work.
Yeah, for this particular book, we had to go to the British Library and essentially recover one of the few remaining copies, and then get it scanned. And obviously, we're working on it from there.
Incredible. That's great work. I mean, this is the kind of thing that something could be lost. You know, there are maybe very few copies of it remaining, and so each one is precious. So thank God you were able to source one and acquire it.
Yeah, the price of this is probably, if one of these were to come out like on the market right now, the price would probably be quite high. But I suppose we'll be reducing that price.
Yeah. Okay, and then the next one is the Indian Mutiny.
Correct. Ah, yes, this is the one. So the Indian Mutiny is not written for children. It's essentially a history book of an event in British Indian history called the Indian Mutiny. And this was essentially a rebellion. Now, the reason it's called a mutiny is because it was particularly Indian soldiers in the British Army who essentially mutinied or rebelled against their superiors and essentially tried to, for lack of better terms, take the country back from the British. Now, this rebellion ultimately failed, but it was a very violent affair, and there were lots of massacres on both sides. In particular, though, you can see kind of savage incidents where the Indians are massacring Europeans. But he is essentially recounting the history of these events, and the emphasis, firstly, obviously, is on telling the story of why this happened and how it happened, but in particular, it's also on the character. Going back to Hilton's main theme, which is character, the character of the people who were in the British Army at the time, right? And kind of emphasizing the bravery of specific people. He recounts, like, for example, an anecdote where essentially, because mutinies were occurring all over the country, so you'd have like a British sergeant or an officer who's standing up to his British or his Indian company of, you know, like a few hundred men, and then giving them orders, knowing that they might mutiny, right? And essentially it's either he's going to get massacred, which is likely, or like by pure like force of will and respect, he'll essentially be able to bring them over. And there's a lot of kind of situations in this rebellion where it kind of could go either way. And it seems to come down to decisions of individual people to carry the day. And that is kind of the history that Hilton is telling. In the Indian Mutiny, and this is a major kind of component, like going back to the broader picture of how Hilton views history. It's very much against like the guns, germs, and steel version of history, where it's like, oh, you know, there was a certain amount of geography, and oh, there was a certain amount of resources, and therefore this country is big and this country is not. It's much more like, okay, through courage and will and force and virtue, people can rise to greatness. And here he's obviously talking about the British people.
Right. This seems like it would be a very valuable historical document because of, because it comes from somebody who was there at the time. And it's telling a story, it's telling a version of history that has been reviled ever since. And as you say, guns, germs, and steel was pushed, it was put about, it seems to be an extremely certainly from my perspective, guns, germs, and steel just seems to be a complete load of nonsense, really. It's promulgated so many lies about human nature, and then this whole thing about that it's the resources and the geography that those dictate what actually happens in history, I think is just nonsense. In the deepest sense, yeah, geography is going to influence a people, but then it's going to shape a people. But then the people and their nature, that becomes a force. And that just seems to be forgotten because, of course, we live in an age that denies that there is any such thing as human nature or that human groups are inherently different. And I think what a British Army general, a major general, would have perceived in India, especially in at any stage in the British Raj, is that groups are inherently different, and that it takes, as you say, will to to shape history. It's not geography at this point, not when we're, you know, high IQ sentient beings at this point. It's us and our decisions, which gets back to his frustration that the British elite just weren't making the right decisions by this time.
Indeed, indeed.
Okay, and then, so that's the fourth book. So which is the fifth book? Is it Imperial Obituary?
No, it's the 13th Power, actually.
Okay, okay, here we go. It's quite a striking cover.
Yes, so this is where you start. So the first two books by Richard Hilton were largely about his own life and his own history, right? The second two books were mainly about India, and the last two books are where he starts to stir the pot, so to speak.
So when was this one published?
1958. So this book in particular has a particular focus on modern Middle Eastern history. And what you kind of have to put in context is that the Suez Crisis had just happened less than 2 years before when he was writing this book. And the Suez Crisis is particularly one of these events which encapsulates the decline and fall of the British Empire, so to speak. Because obviously you have the situation with the Suez Canal. I'm sure a lot of people in the audience are aware of the events, but you have this situation in the Suez Canal where Egypt attempts to nationalize the canal and seize it by force. And Britain and France are both able to militarily eject the Egyptians from the canal. But due to political pressure from the United States, as well as internally and politically, eventually they just leave. Right. And this is very much kind of going back to what how Hilton views the world. He's like, what are you doing? Right. And at the time as well, Great Britain had a lot of involvement in the Middle East. Right. So obviously there's no British colonies in the Middle East anymore, unless you count that military base in Cyprus. But at the time there were colonies in the Gulf. There was involvement in the Suez Canal. The British army was also, there was Mandate Palestine, right? So you get to hear a lot about the Mandate Palestine situation and the origin of Israel. But this book basically describes a history of the Middle East up to 1956, 57, from a British perspective, which is, I guess, in so far as histories of the Middle East are concerned, is not entirely common. Like the most you might get from a modern history of the Middle East would be like, oh, the British were here and the British drew up a border and this is bad. Right. But you get this kind of comparison of Britain to its past and obviously a Middle Eastern analysis.
It's amazing how fast this all happens. This is not a large period of time that we're talking about. It's 50 years, really, from the height of the British Empire to its end. It's really remarkable because we're not talking, I mean, it's what, 70 years, another 70 years have passed since this was written. So it's remarkable. Okay, Iso, is there anything you'd like to say about this?
I don't have too much to add onto this book. I have not actually finished reading this. I've got it in front of me right now, but I would say that this is definitely one of the spicier ones from a modern perspective, just because of some of the subject matter touches on some modern conflicts which are still in contention.
Yeah, if you're interested in the Israel-Palestine conflict, you'll definitely find something interesting to read about in this book.
Yes, it is quite interesting.
Back on the theme of kind of bringing books back, this particular book was also completely out of print, and there was no like online scanned edition anywhere. Again, we had to make our way out to a library. This time the library was in the United States. We had a volunteer out there, found a book, got it scanned, had to bring it, put in editing work to produce it. And, now it's on our website for sale. Excellent. Yeah.
Well done.
Thanks. So this is also where Hilton kind of starts to get into trouble. He doesn't get into too much trouble yet, but he's obviously making a point that he also starts to make a point where he says that this was particularly controversial. He said that it is not necessarily true that the majority population of a colonial country wants to be quote unquote independent. right? Now, Hilton points out that it's mainly the intellectuals in these countries that actually advocate for independence, and ironically, the type of people who would have been educated in Britain, or, you know, for other countries, educated in France, if it's like a French colony. And Hilton kind of points out that, you know, like a lot of these colonial territories were kind of still in a world before nationalism. So like, and obviously you have many different ethnic groups in a colony like India. So there's no particular reason why, say, a Pashto would think like, oh, you know, India as a concept should be like one giant country in independence, right? No, according to Hilton, the majority populations of these countries are not necessarily for or against independence, right? It's more the intellectual class. But this is obviously a very controversial point. Definitely today, right? If you say this today to certain people, this would you'd get into an argument. But obviously, even back then, as decolonialism is happening.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting as well that this is a point which, when made in these cases, is considered very controversial. But you'll hear, you know, like center-right figures make essentially the same point, except they only talk about like French intellectuals and communist countries. But it's the exact same process that he's describing here.
All right. See, this is something that I find quite exciting, that it sounds like, especially this and Imperial Obituary, it sounds like each of them packs a real punch, and it's a sort of compression of ideas and sentiments and accounts of the real world that only he witnessed, maybe a small number of other people. But the point is that it's so valuable because it's so unique and rare. And again, this is why I'm just really glad that you're giving these books new life. And of course, as I said earlier, The 13th Power and Imperial Obituary might be the ones that pack the most punch, but then the other four, yeah, I'm sure each of them has something to offer that's unique as well. So this is why it's so important that you're publishing them. Is there anything else you want to say about this book before we move?
No, I think I summarized it, but more to your point, like if you want like 13th Power and Imperial Obituary are definitely the ones that contain the punch. But if you want kind of the intellectual and world building kind of foundation of what leads to this, it's very valuable to read kind of the history that goes into it.
Beyond all of that, I think the most important thing, beyond the actual facts of what happened in these places, is to try and learn from his worldview on these things. Because, I mean, what we're missing today, you know, is not like the facts of what happened in India or in another part of the empire, but it's the actual attitude of people like Richard Hilton, Major General Richard Hilton. And that's what really needs to be taken in by the people who read this.
All right. And then we'll move on to the Imperial Obituary. So this seems to be his most famous book, and the one that is the most powerful. Which of you would like to describe this and introduce this? And again, we've got an hour, so take as long as you want to give this the detail that it deserves.
Yeah, well, sure. So going back kind of to the timeline of books, and also to the theme of are you published, Hilton was being published by what you might call quote-unquote normal publishers up until The 13th Power, where he was then published by essentially an independent publisher. What this means is essentially a person who published under their own like name, not under a company, but was able to do all the paperwork. So 13th Power was kind of published by a sympathetic person, but Imperial Obituary was also, it wasn't anything like self-published. Instead, though, it was published by a publishing house called The Britons, which you could kind of describe as like a right-wing quote-unquote dissident or just controversial publishing house from 70 years ago or 60 years ago. Wow. So basically being published by these people was already a mark against you. These people would also publish other books, specifically about the fall of the British Empire.
We should say that this was published in 1968, so 10 years had passed since The 13th Power. So yep. presumably in that time he was, presumably in that time he was looking for someone who would publish him and specifically this work, and eventually find the Britons.
Yeah, if you, when reading it, if you read it in detail, you can you definitely tell that certain passages were probably written in, say, 1965 or, you know, earlier. But he was definitely looking for a solution to publish. And obviously, you know, you have things like Millennial if you want to present a new publisher to the community. But obviously, you don't have this type of these types of means of communication back then. Yeah,
indeed.
But at this point, Hilton is 70, in his 70s, and he's essentially looking back on the British Empire. And at this point, it can kind of be said without a shadow of a doubt that the British Empire is dead, right? The book is called An Obituary. Now, obviously, like in the 50s, when 13 Powers written, you still have plenty of British presence in the Middle East. But a lot of that goes away by the 60s, and lots of decolonization continues to go on, in particular in Africa as well. Now, what Hilton does in this book is that he essentially provides a timeline of the British Empire from essentially 1,000 years ago to the time that he writes. So he is describing why the British Empire grew, why it was Britain that was the empire. And he does that for several chapters, describing particular fronts, like how the British got India, how the British got the Americas, and then lost the Americas. The chapter on the American Revolutionary War is, you could argue it's pretty brutal, because it kind of lays bare a lot of the tactics that were used in the Revolutionary War. And then it goes into,
it's just worth noting as well on the American question there. He's very, he lays out a strong justification for why he thinks that it should have remained British. He's obviously not in favor of the American independence from a British imperial perspective, right? He's very, very on the whole idea of the blood and the treasure that Britain put towards keeping that land British and having it just, you know, come out from under them.
Yeah, he kind of views like the revolutionaries is very ungrateful, because the context as well of the American Revolution, this is a bit of a tangent, but shortly before, there were plenty of wars with the French and with the Indians as well to essentially, you know, preserve the colonies, right? And these obviously cost money, and then you raise taxes. But then people are like, hey, I don't want to pay taxes, which is a bit frustrating if you're the British.
Yeah, but, he goes through like specific naval battles of saying, like, if it wasn't for us here and here and here and here, right, this would be Spanish or French territory.
Yeah. And maybe going back a little to the point in the 13th Power, but in a different context, it's not necessarily the case that the majority of people in that colony wanted independence. It was more that you had a very organized, insistent section of the population that was able to essentially raise armies and... he describes it almost as terrorism. Well, he actually does literally use the word terrorism that helped to win the day for American independence. But relating more to the modern day, because this isn't even the height of the British Empire. The British Empire still, like 100 years later, gets to its height. But the particular harm that Hilton sees in American independence is not just that it's independent, but also that it comes with a very strong anti-British bias, like in its kind of essential essence. Even if you have things like the special relationship today, the fact that the founding myth of America is essentially an anti-British, anti-traditional, anti-monarchical revolution is something that it ends up being detrimental to Britain later in his view. He then continues to essentially lay out the more recent history, obviously the 19th century. But then he starts to get into the seeds of decay, right? Like what exactly is starting to cause the empire to fall here. And if you've read the other books up until this point, you'll see it synthesized here. So maybe it won't be too surprising to understand, but you'll definitely understand where this is coming from. So he goes into stuff like, in particular, character, right? So the type of people who are administering the British Empire, in the early 20th century are not the same people who did it 50 years before. And they are not the same people who did it 50 years before that, who were able to, for example, take India. And he also points out, as a lot of people realize, that, the world wars definitely didn't help. You know, hundreds of thousands, millions of your best men, you know, being killed in the trenches is not exactly conducive to national longevity. Then he also goes in more in particular into, depending on the vocabulary you use, essentially the globalist agenda. He in particular is looking at essentially colonialism and also the United Nations. This is something he talks about a lot more in the 13th Power, which we didn't mention, but like in particular the role of the United Nations as kind of a governing institution. Because Hilton also sees ahead of him essentially one world government as a potential threat. Which is kind of what you have in globalism. But Hilton proceeds to go to various theaters where the British Empire is failing and sort of explains why it's fallen. And he also provides very scathing remarks on particular incidents. So one of the most, one of the best parts of the book, in my opinion, is one of the parts that Academic Agent actually read on this channel. So there is a section where Hilton is essentially quoting the Viceroy of India in the 1920s. They essentially have in a report that they've written about how they're going to decolonize India. And this is in the 20s. They're saying, okay, we understand that the peasantry of India are, quote unquote, pathetically content, right? And we need to break them out of this pathetic contentedness because of the faith that is in us. These are kind of the two highlighted words. The British, the peasantry in British colonial India are pathetic for being content. And we have a particularly strong faith that India should be decolonized, which is a pretty crazy thing for a viceroy of India to say, right?
Yeah, definitely. That's amazing.
But then obviously immediately after this quote, what Hilton does is like, oh, by the way, you know, like shortly after independence, you had the partition of Pakistan and India, and you had massive massacres and hundreds of thousands of deaths, all of because the faith that is in us. Great job, guys. Kind of in this kind of sarcastic manner. But it encapsulates pretty clearly that a lot of the kind of assumptions and a lot of the motivations that went into essentially the deconstruction of the British Empire were not entirely, I guess the right word would be valid.
I think this is as well.
So go on.
Yes, sorry, Woz. I think this is as well why these books are such an important part of the literary canon in these sorts of circles, because there's this implicit understanding of the fact that these things are driven by elites, right? He recognizes this and points it out explicitly, and not just in theory, right? It is, you know, it's not the peasantry rising up. It is these guys, these specific people in positions of power who are deliberately moving things in these directions.
Well, yeah, and what I'm thinking is, if that was happening in the 20s with the Viceroy, presumably he would have been educated and trained in the 20 or 30 years before, so the 1900s or the 1890s. And so clearly, even by then, something was deeply wrong. But I don't know. Could it be that... it was after his education that once he got into the working world and he realized, oh, the Indians are treated so badly. It's so against my education. I don't know. But then why didn't his predecessor think that 20 years before him?
Well, these ideas were at least starting to come through back in Carlyle's day, right? Which was another 60, 70 years before that. It had been building for quite a long time. I mean, you could even say, that it went all the way back to even at the time of the American Revolution, right? With I think this is one of Yarvin's hobby horses. I might be misremembering, but on the way that the Whigs just kind of actually wanted them to become independent.
Well, you see, the my earliest yardstick here would be the Boer War. I think the Second Boer War, around 1900, 1902. And I know that that caused a lot of controversy because of the deaths of so many people from starvation in the concentration camps. I know that a lot of what you might now call bleeding heart liberals back in Britain were angered by that. I don't know if that was the start of the decline of the British Empire, but clearly, if you've got 20 years later, you've got the Indian viceroy saying that Britain should withdraw from India, then clearly something was changing very, very rapidly.
Yeah. Hilton kind of points out in particular also that specific institutions, takes up the example of the Fabian Society, which is essentially a social democratic left-wing type, in the modern days, essentially an interest organization and a think tank. They're very associated with the Labour Party today. But back then, they still existed. And in particular, they helped found the London School of Economics, right? Which is a very prestigious university. And Hilton also brings up, like, okay, this is a very prestigious university. Lots of, Britain's best and brightest go there. And it's essentially a anti-imperial indoctrination camp. Not his words, kind of a paraphrasing of his words. But I suppose there's no new things under the sun in that. Obviously, like, you know, maybe 10 years ago, people were talking all the time about how, you know, college is a liberal indoctrination camp. Well, you know, well, let me tell you about 100 years ago. Is kind of what Hilton tells us here.
Yeah. And then by the 20s and 30s, Cambridge was full of literal communists. So okay. So, is there anything else that you'd want to tell people about Imperial Obituary? This seems like a fascinating book and very relevant to a lot of people in our circle.
It's hard to say. There's not too much else. At the end, how Hilton closes the book, he kind of points out how Britain could proceed in the international stage, even though the empire has fallen. But he very much kind of acknowledges that the situation is very grim and that people are really going to have to mobilize and fight, or it's just going to get a lot worse, right? And he points this out in the immigration field, right? And this is one of the reasons why this particular book was canceled or unpopular, but also just like more generally in how Britain views itself and the character of the British people. He kind of makes some suggestions for how Britain should proceed. Most of them aren't heeded, as you might imagine. They're also kind of particularly, you can kind of compare it to today, where he's complaining about certain things like, oh, Britain's population density is super high. It's 800 people per square mile. And it's like, well, you know, today it's actually 1,200 people per square mile. Like, and he's just like, this is overcrowded. And with all the immigration, it's going to cause serious problems. And obviously, you know, 60 years later, you still have these problems are getting worse. But even though he was writing in the 60s, the message is still very pertinent in that the situation is grim, but we still need to rally, right? We need to rally, and we need to start building a path forward. And I think that's a very good way for Hilton to kind of close off Imperial Obituary, and also, since it's the last book, essentially a good way to close off the series of Richard Hilton books.
Yeah. One thing I would pick up on is his predicting of world government or one world government, because, of course, that's true. That is what was built to a great extent, not totally, but to a great extent. And we've recently seen in COVID an attempt to advance that even further with the World Health Organization and the WEF and so on. So And it seems to me that long before that, that is what each of the national governments was serving. Again, something seems to have happened at a very high level right after 1945. And all of these national governments were no longer acting in the interests of their peoples or even their own constitutions. And I think about a politician that you neither of you will probably have heard of him, but Nick Clegg. Someone like that, he was the leader of the Lib Dems in Britain in the 2000s and early 2010s. And someone like that, he started off his political career in the EU and then went into national politics. And all through that was loyal to the EU. And then now he works at Facebook, I believe. He went to Silicon Valley, which seems significant in itself. But the point is that this must have been visible, well, in the 60s for sure. If you were at a high level, I think if you were an ordinary member of the public, it might not have been obvious at all what was going on, that nations were, at least in theory, at least the plan was to just dissolve nations. Ordinary people probably didn't realize that. But at a high level, such as Richard Helton was operating at, and he was connected to all sorts of people still, it might have been quite obvious what was going on and what the future plan was.
Yeah, Hilton, in the book, he in Imperial Obituary, he kind of frequently asks for, he wished that you would have someone like Churchill, not Churchill, but someone like Churchill who could, similar to what was done in 1941, like when Britain was close to collapse, someone who could essentially point out the seriousness of the situation and rally the country into some sort of response, right? And that's what Hilton is kind of desperate to see. But obviously it doesn't happen. Instead, you get this globalism. Kind of going back to the 13th power for just a second, the actual title of the book refers to international finance, because what Hilton does in the book, he lists basically all the powers, the international powers that have an impact in the Middle East. Right now, the beginning of this list is what you might actually call a power, like, okay, Russia, Britain, the United States, France, right? Like actual powers, the Ottoman Empire. But then as you proceed to the modern era, and essentially like there are like several powers at the beginning, and then he starts adding more powers as he goes through his history of the Middle East, you start getting more modern powers, like stuff is like Afro-Asian democracy, which is kind of like the decolonialist movement. We might call it third worldism in our modern language. But then he moves into eventually the 13th power, which is international finance. And he views this also as a major mechanism of one world government, because he views that, okay, major financial heads are able to influence national bureaucracies in a way that that would seem unnatural, especially to someone in the warrior caste. He particularly brings up the example of, I need to double check, I think it's Bernard Baruch. You can see in the book the exact name if I'm misquoting that. But he particularly points out this particular person seems to just be able to get meetings with FDR and Winston Churchill at the height of World War II whenever he wants, right? That comes with a lot of power, right? But in the history books, like, okay, we're expected to just ignore this, right? So going into the point that, like, a lot of national governments are kind of betraying their constitution and betraying their mandate and betraying their empires, these powers, so to speak, these modern powers are a part of it. And it's obviously something that Hilton looks at and just laments.
Right, right. Okay, I mean, that's all fascinating. And indeed, at the time, there would have been this transition from national powers, nations, countries, as the seats of empires, to, well, it's like the, what was it, the elephant and the whale. It's to the transition to a power that doesn't really exist anywhere in particular. It's everywhere, all at once. Yeah, It must have been quite an incredible thing to witness. And what we've seen, it's interesting what's happened since, because I think this was really attempted. This world that he saw coming was really attempted, and I think it has failed, and I think it's disintegrating now. I think we're returning to maybe a national existence, or maybe something even smaller, more granular than that. I don't know. But yeah, this all sounds just fascinating. So I'm really glad, just to say one last time, I'm really glad that you're publishing all six of his books and with the short stories as well. That's great. Nice bonus. Because otherwise they would just be stranded. So yeah, congratulations on this project. I think it's very, very worthwhile. To move on from Richard Hilton, we've got 30 minutes left, so we can talk about the other books that you've published. Let's talk about Anti-Politics, since that's obviously a major one. Iso, would you like to take that?
Yeah, sure. Anti-Politics is this is the book that's published from the collection of speeches and Substack articles by John Sweeney and Evelyn on their on their Substack that's referred to as Anti-Politics. This is if people are familiar with their work, there's a lot of stuff in there that people would recognize from. Well, I mean, if you've read the Substacks, you'll have seen some of this, right? But also the streams. And this is where they really outline, there's a specific focus on who and what the elites actually are. And this is part of, I guess you could say, the other aspect of what we're actually doing with Wilfings, which is trying to create a space where people who are in this community can have their own works published. Right, so it's not just about bringing back these books that are out of print, but also getting things like this down on paper and into a form that's more permanent. Consumer, do you want to go more into the specifics of how this came about and what we were looking at with it?
Well, I mean, the way it came about is kind of that. Scrump and Evelyn, John Sweeney and Evelyn Grant, they kind of needed somewhere to obviously publish the book. And they're very kind of in the space, and they kind of agree with the general mission, which is also to provide it a publishing situation that is in the community. And more to Iso's point, this is very much we try to make it as much a community effort as possible. So we're, for example, volunteer run, right? We're all volunteers, no one really makes a profit. We're not profitable yet, but the way it came about obviously was that they were essentially looking for someone who kind of suited them as a publisher, and we were able to provide that, and then we obviously made it happen. It's essentially a compilation of their Substack essays, as well as speeches given at conferences, as well as additional material. And compiling stuff, especially like oral speeches, but also, you know, internet articles into this format, finds a way, you know, getting back to the beginning point of this talk, is it provides a certain permanence to ideas that we really like to promote. And this is the type of work that we'll also be doing more of, not just old books, but these types of books as well.
Yeah, and it looks like you'll be doing more by Scrump and Evelyn, because that's volume one. So presumably there will be at least a volume two.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay. And would you like to talk about any of your other books that you've published? Because I saw others on the website, and I've got their covers ready. I don't know if you want to go into those.
You could take. You see the cover with the lemons on it.
Which one is it? What's the title?
It's called What is Mafia?
Yes, I've got that. Yeah.
Yeah. So another angle in our work to bring back certain types of forgotten books and also old books is to essentially translate books that don't exist in English. right? Now, this particular book is called What is Mafia? It's a book, it's essentially a very short book written by Gaetano Mosca. And this is essentially a speech that he gave about the phenomenon of organized crime in the 1900s. Mosca was an Italian judge and you could call it philosopher. He's also one of the core elite theorists, if people in the audience have heard of elite theory. He's more famous for other books, but in this particular book, you get a description of the phenomenon of organized crime. And we're not the first people to kind of bring it back into English, but it's our first step into translation. And we're also going to be bringing back other short books by Mosca, which have not been translated to English at all. And also more generally, because we have a pretty good Italian translator. Bobby, if you're watching, we love you. But we are also going to be working on other translations of books from Italian. In particular, an interesting one, which is coming up soon, is a book actually on the Russian Revolution called Bolsheviks by an author called Mikhail Peruvkin. We don't have it on the website yet, but it'll be out in January. But this particular author was an ex-Bolshevik who was writing in 1918, kind of at the end of the Russian Revolution, in Italian. Now, the reason he had to write in Italian was essentially he was too worried about getting on the wrong side of the Soviet authorities, but he provides a kind of portrait, of a personal portrait of like leading Bolshevik figures, which at the same time is very very entertaining to read and very insightful.
Right. Yeah, this is the kind of thing. I think it's very interesting. It's valuable, again, because it's one person's account, someone who was actually there. And there might be very few accounts of what it was actually like to meet this person or that person. So I think this stuff is really, yeah.
Yeah, you get a lot of banger quotes from Lenin and from Trotsky, for example. But this is the type of category that we're working on, essentially, which is bringing back older works, but also translating them from languages that aren't in English. These particular works are in Italian, but we're also working on German translations, which is something we'll talk about later.
I just want to say on the subject of translations, this is a part of what led into this is part of the sort of core mission of a lot of the projects that we work on at Beowulf. So this is it. Not only is it something that is providing a service for people by making it available to people who wouldn't otherwise be able to read these things, but also a lot of what we do is to try and foster international cooperation among people who are on our side of things. And it's actually kind of relates back to what Major General Richard Hilton was talking about with the internationalism of the people that he was contending with in his time. This is all sort of meant to bring people in alliance, essentially, to be able to deal with these problems on the same level that they're operating. So having a sort of canon of intellectual work that's accessible to people in all sorts of these in the different European countries is definitely a big part of this.
Yeah. Okay. Would you like to talk about any of the other books?
The rest of the books on the website currently are mostly from Shielding's events. So
right. Yes, I've got L&A Catalog, Entropy, Logo versus Praxis, and A New Order.
Yeah, we can take up the new order since that's the latest one if you want to show a cover. But essentially, Shielding's Events holds conferences every year in the UK, but also in Germany and in Australia, which essentially bring together speakers from our space in a physical setting, right? And obviously, if you want to actually hear the speeches in person, the only way is to actually go to the event. But some kind of record of the actual ideas discussed is provided in these books, where essentially you have the chapters, and each of these chapters has artwork. It's a pretty beautiful hardback. And obviously you have the speeches of each of these speakers, and it's essentially preserves a record of these events. And we have these so far for the previous Shielding's conferences, so 2024, 2023, 2022 in the UK, but there will also be for the Shieldings conference in Germany that happened earlier this year. We will eventually have that on the website soon, as well as an event in Australia. So this is definitely one more of a niche category compared to anti-politics, maybe, or Richard Hilton, but it's on the website, and we believe it's quite valuable to preserve this record as well.
We should also mention that there's going to be a change in the format of these books going forwards. So in years to come, we'll be producing a singular book for each of the events that's held that year, starting in 2026.
Yeah, it sounds like that makes sense. So it would end up forming a sort of chronology. So yeah, it's a good idea. Okay. All right. So that's the various books that are available.
One thing actually that we should mention with this is that we're also doing distributing for Tall Men Books, which is the book publisher run by George Bagby. Now, they have a focus largely on American history, but we have a selection of books that we think would be interesting to a more European audience and Americans as well. Although I believe it would be Americans can also get them specifically from his website. But for anybody interested, we have a selection of five books from Tallman Books on the website as well.
Right, okay. And I think this gets us to how people can get involved. If there are people who would like to help Wilfing's publishing, then and it sounds like one area would be translation work. But would one of you like to talk about this?
Sure. Just on the subject of volunteering with Wilfing's. This has actually been one of the places where we have been really pleasantly surprised with how many people are interested in getting involved with this project. You know, we knew that there was going to be some level of interest in this, but it was beyond even what we had expected. I think we've got 20-some people working with Wilfing's in some way or another. Is that right, Consumer?
Sorry, what was that?
The number of people we have for volunteers. Are we at 20 now?
Probably. And the types of skills that we get for volunteers is not just like, you know, translators. It's editors, it's artists, it's translators, it's distributors. It's essentially all kinds of services that could be useful for a publisher, right? And these are people who, you know, no one works is able to work full time, and it's not a profitable enterprise yet, but we are able to essentially, with everyone contributing, you know, a few hours a week at least here and there, we're able to build the capacity to continue with the mission. So if you want to if you want to help us out, you can send an email to us or send a message on Twitter, and we'll get back to you.
Yeah, if you contact either me, my Twitter's open. A lot of people will see me in, if you're in basket weaving, you can find me in the basket weaving Discord, or if you can go to the website and get consumers' contact information.
I should just underline, your name is Sensible Esocentrist on Twitter.
Yes. I should say as well that just in relation to Wilfing's as a community project, it's not just people, you know, helping out with the actual production of these books, but we're also very interested to know what sorts of things people would like to see republished, right? There's a lot of works that, you know, by the nature of the fact that they're not in print, are obscure, but would be good to bring out. And so if you know what they are, like if you've found something that, you know, you'll probably see those like $800 copies of some book going on eBay, right? For if it's something that's out of print like that, and you'd like to be able to get a copy of it, let us know, right? And we'll see if it's something that would fit with Wilfing's and try and get it produced again.
Excellent. So that's how people can get involved. And these are the skills that you need. Is there anything else that you would say in that regard that, that people might find that they have skills they could offer that they might not think you need?
Yeah, if you're willing to if you're looking to volunteer, right? There's so many more things than we could describe in this time for what can be done. And there's things that, you know, we might not even have thought about until somebody comes and says that they're able to do it. So, you know, don't worry about it, whether or not you, you know, currently have something that was listed out there. If you're interested, reach out to us and we'll talk to you and sort something out.
Okay, I just saw the file that you sent me, the cover of Bolsheviks, Consumer. Sorry, I wasn't looking.
No worries.
My apologies. But I'll put it up on screen now just so that people can see it and have an idea. Here it is.
Yeah.
There we go. Oh, that's a nice cover.
Yeah.
Well, it's grim, obviously, but it's I like the design.
Yeah, the author describes certain people also in kind of animalistic terms as well. So that's part of the inspiration for the cover. But this will be out in late January. So just wanted to preview that as well.
Okay. Thanks, Wes. All right, excellent. Okay, then. Well, is there anything else that we should say about Will Things before we wrap? Oh, well, actually, there are some super chats. So have a think about final thoughts and I'll just go through the super chats. Okay. Somebody, anonymous person, gave a donation. There's no question, but very generous donation. So thank you very much. The Thin Red Line said, these rare books from old warriors with differing views are very important. Thank you for publishing them. I agree. And Barbarossa said, hello, salute to the English warrior. Which book he wrote has the most action in it? I think he's referring to Richard Hilton. Which one has the most action?
they all kind of have action. I mean, if you want shooting and explosions, it's going to be probably Nine Lives. And you have all kinds of situations where this happens. It'll be stuff like, okay, he's hanging out of an airplane because like there's a problem with the airplane. Like there's one anecdote where... it's a bit of a tangent, but like I mentioned, he was a pilot towards the end of the First World War. And one of the tasks they had was essentially to drop like tiny bombs from the plane. But sometimes these bomber hangers in the planes would jam. So in particular, in this particular case, the bomb was armed, but it had not been dropped from the plane. So he had to like step out of the plane, kind of step under it into the bomb bay. And this is like a biplane, right? And he has to kick the bomb to get it off the plane while it's armed,
which is
a pretty precarious thing. And here you get like all kinds of stuff of British upper lip. There's another anecdote where like he was an observer, so he was like not the pilot, but his pilot essentially gets blinded and disoriented. And Hilton also gets blinded and he's just like, oh, well, it's a bit rough to be blinded, but like having my pilot crash into the ground would be a little steep, right? You know, just like this classic British kind of upper lip type reaction.
Stiff upper lip, yeah.
To answer the question, like this book has a lot of kind of personal action. So if you want kind of like one person like in the war doing stuff, this book has action. Otherwise, Military Attaché in Moscow has a lot of action, though not like, you know, shooting and explosions. If you want like more just historical accounts of battles, that would be The Indian Mutiny, which will be out next month.
Well, we shouldn't also forget The Northwest Frontier is a true story for boys. And if anybody has kids, they should be reading that when it comes out.
Yes, indeed.
All right. Okay, so before we wrap up, final thoughts on Will Things and what you intend for the project, where you would like to see it go in the future, and why people should take an interest in.
Yeah, I just have one last thing to announce here. So there's a lot of things that we're working on to expand the scope of what Will Things is doing in the future. A lot of this isn't ready to be announced publicly yet, but one thing that has just come through is that we've actually acquired a piece of a company called Legent, which is an audiobook and digital book platform to and they have a huge catalog of subjects, academic subjects that they address. So this is a big part of it, and you should check them out as well. They're going to be integrated in all sorts of ways with this in the future. So there's a part of what we're doing to expand Wilfings, and you know, over the next year or so, you should see more interesting things, not just in the books published, but in the way Wilfings operates.
All right, that sounds very interesting. Consumer, any final thoughts?
Well, as for closing remarks, so I guess if you want to take anything from this, Wilfings Publishing is a new publishing house that's out here. We bring back lots of old books. And also some new books, and we are going to be essentially in the coming year expanding our catalog and providing hopefully books that are quite valuable to you all. We mentioned translations as well. You can look forward to in the next year Wilfings in Germany, publishing books in German, which I think will hopefully should be pretty exciting to some of our German friends. And with that, I just want to say, if you want to support us, feel free to volunteer. You can contact us by email or on Twitter, or, you know, perhaps even buy a book.
Excellent. I hope people do, and thus help Wilfings to prosper and continue into the future and keep doing good work. So excellent. Well, Consumer and Sensible Ethocentrist, thank you for appearing in order to publicize Wilfings. I think this has been very interesting, and I think the work sounds very worthy. So congratulations on it, and please keep going.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for having us on.
All right, you're welcome. I'll be back in 15 minutes with the next stream, but in the meantime, Consumer and ESO of Wilfings, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Thank you, Wilfings.
Thank you.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? T-shirts, mugs, and posters are available in the merchandise store. The perfect way to remember this unique time. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.